Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for more traditional exercise such as weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447. Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, August 20th, 2014, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons. I'm joined today by Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. It's been a long time since we've been able to say that. Welcome back, gentlemen.
Good to be back.
Since our last conversation, so much has happened in Ferguson. Nearly a dozen reporters have been arrested while on the job. We've learned the name of the police officer who shot and killed Michael Brown, and one St. Louis TV station even aired video of his home. Governor Jay Nixon has instituted and lifted curfews and has called in the National Guard. We're going to spend the next half hour talking about so much of this and how the media has covered it. I want to start by asking both of you for some of your overall impressions of what you've seen this week.
I'm going to start out by something that we probably wouldn't talk about otherwise, but I was really interested in how the international media have been covering this story. You would expect to get the kind of coverage from some of our adversaries, Russia, China, Iran. You know, they've run the stories that basically fit their sort of anti-U.S., anti-Western, you know, beliefs, you know, blowing it up to be this huge crisis in America and all about how America is hypocritical. Now, that doesn't mean those storylines don't have some bit of truth to them, but it's interesting to watch how the international media have been covering it. And I thought it was really interesting, Amy, an American journalist took a stab at what we might report if Ferguson was happening somewhere else. Hmm. And I think it's kind of instructive. So here's a story. A guy's name is Max Fisher from Vox, and here's just two sentences of what he wrote. Chinese and Russian officials are warning of a potential humanitarian crisis in the restive American province of Missouri, where ancient communal tensions have boiled over into full-blown violence. The crisis began a week ago in Ferguson, a remote Missouri village that has been a hotbed of sectarian tension. That's how we would report it if this was happening somewhere else. Pretty close to the mark.
Yeah, I think it's pretty close. Well, I guess my impression is that I'm going to quote a civil rights icon, Fannie Lou Hamer, where she said, you know, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. And that's pretty much what I'm feeling here and looking at the coverage of the media of the Ferguson situation. It's the classic, we have a problem here, and now we're going to tell you what the problem is, despite the fact that the problem's been there for a generation, and we really haven't done anything about it, but we want to tell you this is the problem. And it's over and over and over again, and it's one of those things of, where were you? Why all of a sudden are you here now? It wasn't a question of if this was going to happen, but when it was going to happen.
And what was going to cause it.
Exactly. And now all of a sudden you have this big microscope on a problem. The question becomes, what's going to happen once it's over? That microscope is going to move on and go somewhere.
Yeah, it's depressingly familiar. I mean, You can just look back to the Trayvon Martin case, but you could look back a generation of stories like this and you say, the media pour in, they do this nonstop coverage for a few days or a few weeks, and then what's left after that?
Right.
There is going to be a grand jury that may start up today, and we may actually at some point get to find out what evidence really exists for what happened and why it happened, but we're not reporting on that because we're not privy to it yet.
Now, I do want to point out that there are some stories out there that are really good. I mean, the Post-Dispatch, I think it was the day before yesterday, had a really good story on, and I think it was called "Why Did Michael Brown Happen in Ferguson?" Mm-hmm. And it really points out how the change in that town from the 1960s to where we are now, and how this pocket, which is really, I mean, they had a map and a graphic and everything, which showed this pocket of African-American, of poverty, not just African-American poverty, but poverty in that particular area, and how the police And government officials, I mean, the police is getting a lot of blame, but the city officials also deserve some blame because they were the ones who enacted basically cordoned off a part of this community and basically instructed the police, make sure that these people are contained in this area. This is what their story was saying. So there's a larger story here that's being underreported by the national media.
I'll say, too, and I was out of the country for the first week of this story, so I might have missed a lot of the early stuff. But one of the best pieces of enterprise reporting I've seen so far was from the New York Times talking about the militarization of police forces since 9/11. I think that was a great bit of reporting, and it shines a light on one of the reasons we've had the response that we've had in Ferguson.
But I want to go back to that because I think that's important. The media has played a role in pushing this militarization, at least highlighting this militarization, but in another way. How many stories have you seen where, right here in Columbia, where the Columbia Police Department gets a tank or Boone County gets a tank?
The MRAPs. And the MRAPs, whatever. I edited a story working with students just this past summer.
And they tried it out, and we highlighted it as if it's something great. And so now all of a sudden, the story is, wait a minute, we have a problem. We're militarizing these police departments, and they're actually using this equipment. Well, yeah. I mean, they got it. Of course, they're going to use it.
Why have it if you're not going
to? Exactly. And the way in which they use it. I mean, they use it in a way that really goes after a small minority of the actual criminal element that's out there. I mean, these SWAT teams are actually going out and serving search warrants. And they're doing it in a way that's really that really impacts their relationship in a negative way to a lot of these communities that they supposedly serve.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about some of the decisions and choices that have been made in newsrooms this week, some of which have really gotten people talking. Friday morning, the police department identified Darren Wilson as the man who shot and killed Michael Brown. By that time, the six-year veteran of the Ferguson police force was already in hiding. But that didn't stop the news media from trying to find him. And in the case of one St. Louis TV station, finding his house, shooting video of it, and airing that. If one of the first goals of journalists is to do no harm, how much harm was done here?
Well, I think that's going a little bit overboard. I don't think you have to tell that story by going to that extreme. I do believe that the news media does need to find out more information about all the subjects involved in this this incident. But to go to that extreme, I think, takes it just a little bit too far.
Yeah, I don't think that they should have done that. I think the competitive pressures probably led them to do it.
And maybe exhaustion, too, after 5 days of
nonstop coverage. As you pointed out in some notes to us, this isn't the first time in recent months that KSDK has had problems. Remember their little fake school invasion story and how they led to locking down the schools where was it? Not Hazelwood.
That was Kirkwood. Right. That there was a sweeps piece that they were working on and did not properly identify themselves, leading to a lockdown.
So it makes you wonder. But I will say, I mean, yes, we need to know more about the officer. There's nothing wrong with trying to find the officer, trying to get reaction from the officer. I noted, by the way, that today, I think it was a British paper maybe that had a friend of his who had been exchanging text messages who finally put out the first quotes from the officer. They don't really reveal very much. He's obviously not at that house. It's too bad, of course, that the police waited so long to release that name. Perhaps things might have turned out slightly differently if they had released it earlier.
Well, during that same news conference, Ferguson Police Chief Tom Jackson released surveillance video of a convenience store robbery taken minutes before Wilson shot Brown. It wasn't until hours after that video was released and aired on several television stations and cable networks across the country that it came out that Wilson didn't know Brown was a suspect in that robbery at the time of the shooting. Jackson said he released the video because he'd been asked for it, much against the advice of Governor Jay Nixon and the Justice Department.
There was peace on Thursday night after you appointed the county police to come in and take over, the state police rather, to take over from the county. But then the local police chief released that video. What justifies releasing the video about the convenience store while there are still no details about what happened with the shooting itself? That is what caused everything to erupt again on Friday night and eventually led to the curfew having to be imposed.
Yeah, we and our security team and the Highway Patrol did not know that was going to be released. I don't think the Attorney General knew that. And quite frankly, we disagree deeply, I think, for two reasons. Number one, to attempt to, in essence, disparage the character of this victim in the middle of a process like this is not right. It's just not right. And secondarily, it did put the community and, quite frankly, the region and the nation, on alert again. These are old wounds. These are deep wounds between in these communities, and that action was not helpful.
On Face the Nation, Jay Nixon called that video incendiary, and what happened as a result of releasing it. Would you have aired that? What kind of reporting needed to happen before airing it?
Well, I think that the reporting was done. I mean, I think that once that video came out, I think that the news media had an obligation to put that out there, but I also think they needed to put it into context, and a lot of them did by basically saying, look, this was released by the police department, and it was not released in consultation with the Justice Department, with the governor's office, or with any of the other entities that have been brought in to try to deal with the situation. This reminds me of a lot of instances where you have local police departments that feel that they are being disrespected by state officials and by federal officials, and we're gonna do something to show that actually we're in charge and we can do something. And this is, to me, is a classic case of that. It blew up. It blew up in their face. It blew up, it caused some other issues involving the state officials and the federal officials. And what happens? It heightens up again. You begin to have violence in that neighborhood because now you basically besmirch the character of the person who is the victim, who can't really speak for himself because he's dead.
I mean, first of all, I think the governor summed it up pretty well, and Ernest summed up what the media's responsibility is pretty well. The only problem I have is it's impossible for the journalists to put that video in context because they don't have the arrest report. They don't have any of the other information that allows us to see the whole picture. So what we are doing, whether we intend to or not, is besmirching the character of the victim. I mean, there was a similar story that came out of Jefferson City. KMIZ ran a piece a few days ago where they said that the guy who was with the victim before he was shot had an arrest warrant out for him in Jefferson City. A tiny little 4 or 5 paragraph story, no detail, no context. That also has the effect, whether it was intended or not, of besmirching the witnesses who would uphold the version of the story of the victim.
And the thing about it is we in the news media make this mistake all the time where we find a piece of information that's tangential to the overall story and we run with it without thinking about what is the context of that? What does it mean? And the one question that seems to be bothering me out of all of this mm-hmm. is we aren't asking the main question, which is why. We should be asking that over and over again. I mean, as soon as that information came out, as soon as that video came out, there should have been a reporter there going, why are you releasing this now? What
does this have to do with it? And that question was asked, and the answer was because somebody asked for it. And that's not an answer.
But here's the thing. They've been asking for more information than that. They've been asking for the name of the officer that did the shooting. They've been asking for the 911 tapes. They've been asking for a whole bunch of information. And the information you release is this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, that to me is you're trying to shape the story to fit a narrative that puts you in a better light than what you're in now. And I don't know who's giving them advice. I don't know if they brought in a professional PR firm. I doubt very seriously because a professional PR firm would not have told them to do that. It's just basically you have cops who don't know how to work with the public, don't know how to work with the media, and don't know how to handle a situation that is blown up on them.
On that same point of trying to control that message, you might say it's an understatement that Governor Nixon's having a hard time getting this all under control, but that was never more evident than Saturday afternoon at the news conference where he announced the curfew.
Will the media be allowed out to report after curfew? Will you allow legal observers, will you allow the media out of the street to report after midnight?
Police attacked us last night. Police attacked women and children last night. They attacked them. We kept them intact. We kept young men back, but they attacked them. Then they went to the press and spared a bunch of lies. This is not working. Police are attacking us.
Yes. So the question is, Governor, will the media be allowed to be out in the streets?
We rescued these
women. No. You already know that.
They attacked the police. Yes, they're attacking this group. They're attacking
us. Governor Nixon, how long will the state of emergency last?
It's just too.
Answer that question, please.
Excuse me, can you explain to us why this whole
ask this one first.
Why this whole conference is focused on controlling the anger of the people, when the whole reason the people are in the streets for a week now is because people are demanding justice, and there has been no arrest, there has been no indictment, and people know that this poor child, this 18-year-old young man, was killed in cold blood, and there has been no arrest, and people are demanding justice. That's why people are in the street, and now this whole press conference has been turned into an explanation of why you are controlling people's anger and suppressing people's anger and telling people to calm down.
Question over here.
So that news conference was held in a church, and ultimately became open to the public. Those questions, mainly not coming from people we would traditionally consider journalists. Last week, we talked a lot about the idea of citizen journalism. This whole news conference spun out of control, but it was initially a totally controllable situation.
Well, initially it was controllable until you allowed
the public
to come in, because then all of a sudden it became, you know, basically what we see on television night in and night out on cable news, which is, you know, everybody giving their opinion, but you're not really getting any answers. And I think that's ultimately what happened. And in a way, you're looking at that and you sort of feel sorry for the governor because he's not getting an opportunity to respond. But then you sort of back up and you say, well, you know, you created this.
Right. By day four or five, you want to look at the governor and say, didn't you kind of exacerbate this situation by waiting until
but
now.
So much of this is just a result of not managing the situation at the very beginning.
Look
at the other shooting that occurred in St. Louis yesterday, I believe it was, right? The black man wielding a knife allegedly robbed a store, allegedly came at officers. They shot him and killed him. The police chief of that St. Louis suburb jumps right into it and is meeting with people in the community and is talking. So the police officials are there, local government officials are there, and that's why
exactly. They explained the situation from the beginning to the end. They didn't hold any information that would have sort of caused that to become a flashpoint.
Right.
So you're absolutely right, Mike. I think they handled that well, whereas in this case they didn't. But it goes back to what I said at the beginning of the show, which is you have a police department that has no credibility in that community. And when things got out of control in that situation, they went back to what they knew, which was, we're going to control the situation by force. And everything that they've done up until the point where the governor stepped in and Highway Patrol get in only exacerbated the issue. And then they compounded it by, once they were pulled out, releasing that videotape and making it even worse.
Okay. Pardon me, Michael Brown's parents gave their first television interview to MSNBC's Politics Nation, but it was their second with CNN's Don Lemon that has people talking. Lemon has been on the ground in Ferguson for the better part of a week, but before leaving, he did a 7-minute interview with Michael Brown Sr. and Leslie McSpadden. I want us to take a listen to the last minute or so of their conversation.
I'm just going to say this to you. As a father, be strong. Make sure your family's okay, but don't be afraid to break down and be vulnerable, because you can do that as a man. And to you, Mom, I don't even know what to say to you except that every mother in this country, in this world, is rooting for you. And so you stay strong. You have the entire world behind you. And if you ever, either of you, need anything, you know how to get in touch with me personally. Thank you, and I'm so sorry for your loss. Truly sorry.
I realize I tend to be a very old school journalist, and I very firmly believe in the idea of objectivity. To me, that was crossing a line. I'd be interested in hearing what the two of you think about that.
Well, I do think that that's crossing a line. That's something that he could have done off the air, and that would have been fine. By doing it the way he did it, he interjected himself into the story. It puts his media organization in a very delicate position. And at some point, someone is going to have to go back and sort of dial that back. I would be very interested to see how his superiors thought about that, about what he did. Now, I can understand his raw emotion about it, because I'm feeling some of that as an African-American man. I'm feeling some of that, too. But I have to, you know, you have to be careful about how you present that. And in the position that he was in, mm-hmm. for him to have done that all of a sudden puts the spotlight on him and not on the story. And that's not what we're supposed to do as journalists, regardless of your ethnicity.
I mean, he obviously believed what he said. He meant it. Said privately, as Ernest suggested, would have been perfectly appropriate. I'm going to put on my cynic's hat, though, and say that I think the problem here is that CNN wants to have it both ways, as does Don Lemon. We have the counterexample, for example, of Al Sharpton over at MSNBC. Everybody knows that he's not a journalist.
But you know that coming into it.
You know it coming into it.
And that was the case when he was hired, and that right. was one of the things that made him attractive to MSNBC.
But Don Lemon and CNN want to have it both ways, an established, respected journalist, but also somebody who is sympathetic and cares and can emote on screen, so that he wants to be both – you know, objective and fair and a traditional journalist and somebody who can break the rules. And I don't think you can have it both ways, or shouldn't have it both ways anyway.
And I would agree with both of you on that statement. And I can tell you there have been situations where I have personally felt certain ways about certain issues and had that private conversation with somebody, be it about politics, be it about the death penalty, be it about right to life issues. We all, as human beings and as journalists, have those feelings. We have those biases, but I don't think they have a place to come out in our work publicly.
No, I would agree with you on that. I mean, and this is a very emotional story, and it does for African Americans, it does hit at, mm-hmm. at hit you at a certain core level. But you have to be able to make your case and make your point in a way that is going to further the story. What I've seen in the coverage, especially of the mainstream media and of cable news, has been more about reacting to what's happening and not really hitting at the core, which is you have, dating all the way back to in some cases, the 1980s, you've had a systematic change in the way in which a certain segment of the African-American community and in some cases African-American community in urban areas, but also whites in rural areas who have been left out of what we want to call the American dream. Mm-hmm. Inequality is real. And a lot of the issues that we've been talking about for a long time are starting to bubble over into some very volatile situations. This being one, there have been others. It's not, like I said earlier, it's not going to be a question of if, it's a question of when. And the when, in a lot of cases, is now.
Okay. There is a blog out there called Photography is Not a Crime. And this week, it's felt like reporters have had to remind law enforcement of that over and over again. Wednesday night, Wesley Lowery of The Washington Post and Ryan J. Riley of The Huffington Post were the first arrested. Police took them into custody at the McDonald's. It has become a place to recharge, write, and refuel for many journalists. Since then, another 10 or so reporters have been taken into custody and released. An Al Jazeera crew was tear gassed, and police dismantled their equipment. And Sunday night, this chilling scene as police threatened to mace Argus Radio's Mustafa Hussein.
Get down! Get out! Get the f*** out of here! You can't stand right up! Or you're getting stoned with this!
The light's off!
Get down!
The light is off!
Get the
f***
out of here! You're in the wrong way!
I got it!
From what we can tell, were these reporters doing anything that outrageous to warrant that kind of a response?
Obviously, there were some reporters who decided for serious journalistic reasons to go outside the cordon that the police had set up for them. Sure, there are issues of security. The police don't want to have seriously injured or dead journalists on their hands. But the effect of what they did, of trying to take over the responsibility for the reporter's safety, was to, whether they meant it or not, and I think they probably meant it in certain circumstances, was to keep us from covering an aspect of the story that the police didn't want to have covered.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, that's been the issue throughout this, is that you have certain police officers who are trying to protect journalists mm-hmm. From being in situations, because a lot of the more violent factions of the protests are using the reporters as shields. Those are several stories I read this morning about that. And the police are trying to sort of ferret that out. But then you also have police officers who are trying to protect themselves in terms of some things that they shouldn't be doing, and they don't want the journalists to see that. So you've got all these elements working in a very moving situation, a very fluid situation, and this is what's been happening. So police, you have a police officer just says, hey, I'm just going to arrest everybody. I can't tell whether you're a journalist or you're a protester, so I'm just going to arrest everybody, and we'll sort it out at the police station.
And when I say this next thing, I'm not trying to defend what the police did, but I will say that just as much as the police departments in some of these smaller suburbs needed better training on how to respond to these kinds mm-hmm. of situations, a lot of these journalists who were there, especially a lot of these local journalists, this is the first time they've ever seen anything like this in their lifetimes. If they weren't in Chicago or L.A. or New York, they've never seen protests like this, and they're not really sure how they can safely cover this story and still cover it well.
Now, interestingly enough, there was a piece on the Pointer website last Thursday, which in the life of this story feels like a lifetime ago. But it was interviews with several local photographers from St. Louis area TV stations who said their experience with the police has been completely different, that they've gotten not for broadcast alerts or warnings that tear gas attacks were about to start, where to be, how to be safe. And we haven't seen the local reporters or photographers involved in any of these arrests or these pushbacks.
And I think the reason you're seeing the national reporters. Mm-hmm. And it's what we talk about all the time. It's the parachute journalism. You're coming in and you're reacting to what's going on around you. You want to be in the best position. You may not be listening to the police because you think that they're going to curtail your ability to cover something. So you're listening to the protesters who are in some cases are using you as shields to get away from the police officers. So now all of a sudden you're being used, and you're in your zeal to get the best coverage, you're being used by one group or the other. And that's a problem.
Okay. Well, before we go, a bit of levity or maybe absurdity. It depends on how you look at it. We were talking about Ryan Riley of the Huffington Post, one of the reporters arrested at the McDonald's. Well, over the weekend, he tweeted this picture of orange. What are those? Rubber bullets? Nope, Ryan. Those are earplugs, the foam kind that you buy a couple of pair for $1 to block out loud noises. If you were to see those on the street, would that be your first thought, rubber bullets?
I don't think that, no, that would not be my first thought. First off, why would they be orange? I don't know enough about rubber bullets
to know what color they are.
I don't think we
are.
Think very clearly yeah. if we're in that situation right. without the training.
Or what you could do is actually ask somebody, what is this?
And ask somebody who's there, yeah. as opposed to putting it on the internet yeah. where everybody is going to be having that kind of a response to it. Well, we're just about out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. There is a lot more that we were hoping to talk about today, including the beheading of a journalist by the ISIS jihad group, and David Gregory's departure and Chuck Todd's ascension as moderator of NBC's Meet the Press. We're going to keep the conversation going online, though. You'll be able to find those segments and more throughout the week on our website, kbia.org, and on our YouTube channel. You can find that at youtube.com/views of the news. You can also like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @views on KBIA. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to Pat Akers for handling the audio. Hope Kerwin is our associate producer. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.